Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight we arrive with our final episode of our series of the managerial rivalries. Before we get onto tonight's subject though, I would just like to introduce the guests and panel of experts who will be guiding us through the next hour. First of all, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Stu. How are we doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Am I detecting man flu has gone?
I'd say 97%. I'm still throwing out the odd shape here and there, but apart from that, yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
excellent update. And now, a welcome return for two former favourites of the podcast and two very carefully selected guests, as will become apparent a little bit later on as we go through this topic. So first of all, we have Man United fan Mr. Daniel Wilson. Daniel, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good, Stu. Thanks. Been a while, but couldn't turn down a chance to talk about the 90s.
are you ready? Are you ready for your half of the battle?
I am, yeah.
Excellent. And then on the other side, we have another welcome return for Mr. Chris Weir. Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm all right. And nice to see that you're doing so well. And in the true Arsenal tradition, I'll probably crumble during this feud at some point.
You like to just fade away at some point and disappear?
Promise much, but deliver little. That's my motto, Stu.
Brilliant. So on we go then. So we have arrived at the 1990s, a time of epic change, and it was epic change in English football, from the return to European club competitions and the dawning of the Premier League to the arrival of some of the best players and coaches in the world. The managerial rivalries it conjured up were both familiar and new. The new decade in which the English game embraced a wider world, probably more than ever. And like I said, this is the fifth and final part of our series of the great managerial rivalries of English football. Tonight, it is the 1990s. So, fellas, I think probably the best place to start with regards to the 1990s, I'm going to come to you first, Stephen. I think, we've got to start with Hillsborough. I think it was a defining moment, certainly a defining moment in English football. It was a defining moment for the future of English football, and at the centre of it, obviously Liverpool, and obviously Kenny Dalglish. So I suppose if you can just take us through a little bit about the impact of the incident and what it led to, sort of from 1990 onwards.
To cut it as short as I can, or as pertinent as I can, Kenny Dalglish basically carried the city for a number of years. He went to all the funerals. He was everything, really. He was focal point. He was the first point of call for media. He and his wife kind of like swung open the doors of Anfield and just let the people through. And that amazing floral tribute that went across the cop and then swept onto the pitch and everything that was just involved with kind of like the opening of the club to the people who needed it, really. And the impact that it had on him wasn't even considered at the time, I don't think. This iconic hero of the Red Side, Merseyside. And it did. It had a deep, deep impact on him, and it hit him hard. And in retrospect, you can see a deterioration in his just whole physicality. Really, he becomes paler and paler as the months wear on. It's that concept of the disaster happened, all of the repercussions of it, the emotional draining of a football club, of a city, and then almost expected to get just to go back to normal. And it wasn't even a case of waiting for a new season to start. It was, you know, the end of that 1988-89 season, and then it was almost like it was just all meant to go back to normal at the start of the following season. And looking back at that, we still played some really good football that season, but there was a degree of autopilot to it. And, you know, we started very well at the start of the 1991 season as well. But he just hit this massive wall. He just hit this massive wall, and you could see the eyes hollow. The stress kicked in massively. And as shocking as it was at the time, in retrospect, I think the main shock is that it took so long to manifest. You know, it wasn't until the February of 1991 that he walked away. And it will have taken a lot for him to have done that. He wouldn't have just done it off the cuff or anything like that. It would have built up and built up and built up. And he basically just had to let it go, and it was the right thing for him to do.
Like you say, I mean, hindsight's a great thing, and, you know, being able to predict the future, you know, and the things that go with that. But had Hillsborough not happened, there's so many tangents you could go off if Hillsborough hadn't happened. But in terms of Dalglish's managerial career at Liverpool, it obviously went on to Blackburn, but do you think pre-Hillsborough there was more left in him? You know, there was more in him for him to achieve, you know, as a manager?
Oh, yeah, there was. I mean, he wouldn't have come back into the game if he felt that he'd done all he needed to do. He was a very under-heralded manager, really. You know, Dalglish, the player, will always outstrip Dalglish, the manager, but he was one of those rare entities that achieved massively as a football player and then did so in the dugout as well. You know, he won 3 league titles at Anfield, a couple of FA Cups, very, very near miss on a 4th title. Was doing quite well in 1990-91 when he walked away. He was just born for success. And then to do what he did with Blackburn as well, which, you know, a lot of people wrote off as being kind of like checkbook management. And it was to a degree, but I think if you look player for player against the Manchester United squad he went up against in 1995, it actually... If you just gave those two lists of players to someone who wasn't around then to have watched it, they'll have wondered how that team won the title against the Manchester United squad of Cantona, of Cole, of all of those star-studded players. You know, this was a Blackburn side of Atkins and May. I know he went on to Manchester United, but, you know, a much more workman-like central defender than, say, Gary Pallister would be. You know, I don't think Dalglish gets I don't think he gets kudos for his managerial achievements back then that he should do. But yeah, I think he'd have done that at Liverpool. He'd have stayed around at Liverpool, I think, for another half decade. You know, maybe that 94-95 title win for Blackburn would have been something he'd done at Liverpool. He could probably pick some of the players that he bought for Blackburn that he would have taken to Liverpool given the chance.
Do you think, you know, the Blackburn, you know, you say it was checkbook management, and I suppose there's pressure that comes with, you know, with money being spent. But obviously with the pressure that came with, you know, being the manager at Anfield, you know, following in the footsteps of Shankly, Paisley, Fagan, you know, do you think the Blackburn job was almost a getting back to enjoying the game again, enjoying being a manager again, enjoying working with the players again?
I think it was an interesting project for them to drop down into the second division, to know that the finances were there to build something new. It was starting from scratch, really. Blackburn, a traditional old football club that had these great successes, you know, way, way, way back. So there wasn't that kind of contemporary history to live up to maintain. It was a blank piece of paper for them, basically. And I think that would have appealed massively to them, rather than going to, you know, a club that was big and established there and then, ready for success. I think he might have struggled with that concept. But I think the idea of walking into Blackburn and just creating something new was just massively appealing to him. I mean, I've heard stories as well, though, that if Liverpool had come back for him when Souness went, for instance, then he'd have he'd have walked back to Anfield, you know, and I believe that. I think it would have been the only job he would have done that for. You know, he was fully invested at Blackburn, and it led to the title in the end. You know.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, I suppose Hillsborough. You know, we've talked about this before. It's potentially its own podcast, and you know, and we do need to move on. But Dalglish, you know, like you say, is such a pivotal figure for, you know, the Liverpool dominance, the saving of a city, you know, as you so eloquently put it at the beginning, and then to go on and not create a dynasty, but certainly to win a title with a very unheralded club, with, you know, like you said, that was in the modern game and achieved very little success. But, you know, I suppose, you know, looking at other managers, and Chris, I'm going to come to you now as sort of the Arsenal expert, if you like. And at mm-hmm. that time with Dalglish, and, you know, Stephen mentioned it sort of slightly earlier, the very near miss. You know, we look at George Graham's Arsenal, and, you know, at the time, I mean, you know, George Graham was, you know, was very highly thought of. You know, the Arsenal size that he'd put together. You're the Arsenal fan for me, watching on, very functional, very, you know, they won football matches, they won major trophies, but in terms of a legacy at Arsenal, you know, how is George Graham's tenure there sort of seen?
Well, the way it ended has slightly coloured their perceptions of George Graham's time at Arsenal, but I mean, as you've mentioned briefly there, he perhaps more than any other manager sort of set in stone the standards, the discipline, the pursuit of excellence that Arsene Wenger would later rely on. He inherited a defence that had been drilled incessantly by Graham. You know, it was his defence. And there were elements of that team, certainly the team's mentality, that Wenger, whenever he assumed the job, recognised as one of the team's greatest assets. But in terms of the winning mentality, the highest standards, you know, George Graham was the standard bearer for that. And, you know, he did win titles, and, you know, there was that momentous triumph in 89 with the Michael Thomas winner, but there was also the 1990-91 triumph, and for a reason we've already went over there, it's not always remembered, and understandably so, but, you know, it was a season in which Arsenal lost only one game across the entire campaign, conceded just 18 goals in the league. And in many senses, you know, were an early prototype of a Mourinho Chelsea, completely un-Arsenal-like, gruff, uncompromising, you know, ruled with an iron fist and a tactical blueprint that made his side very hard to beat. You know, very functional, as you say, and very rigid. You know, as Will, our esteemed colleague, has written a good article about that season in particular, and he mentions a quote from Fever Pitch in it, where he suggests that Nick Hornby, that Highbury had become a devil's island in the middle of North London. You know, it was very... Arsenal was a team that no one liked. You know, by the mid-2000s, Arsenal were the neutral's favourite. Back then, they were everyone's favourite enemy. And that signing there, that season in particular, was almost the triumph of Graham's Arsenal, and that it was a frugal team, very sober, built in his image, you know, was eager to kick a shin, a score a goal. But it made them, you know, top competitors, and of course that was the year when a certain David Seaman joined from QPR. They're the best signing in it of a mixed bag, really. He signed Andy Linegan, who really had no chance of usurping Tony Adams or Steve Bould that year. Well, Adams had certain difficulties, which we'll pick up on. But you know, speaking of Adams, that was the year, of course, where he was under the influence and crashed his car, and obviously went to prison for a period to serve that. And you know, Adams was the standard bearer in two very counterintuitive ways at the club. You know, firstly, he was the young captain, the driver, the enthusiastic sort of figurehead of the team, but also the preeminent member of the Tuesday Club, the hard drinking, insidious culture that really set root amongst the club and its stars at the time. But that was part of the almost insanely macho, masculine, stiff upper lip and probably another pay culture that really pervaded the English game, but particularly the Arsenal at that time. And that season, interestingly as well, was it felt like the beginning of the nascent rivalry with Manchester United. There was a very bad-tempered game between the two that seen Brian McClure try and launch a few kicks at a prone Nigel Winterburn, you know, and sparking a 20-man brawl on the pitch that had both teams deducted points. And that was an interesting sort of prelude into what would, obviously, from 1996 to 2004, really make the Premier League, I believe, into what it would, such a commercial behemoth that it is. You know, that rivalry, which we'll come into, I'm sure, in depth later on, was absolutely enthralling. It had every ingredient. It had competition. It had outstanding technical football. It had great characters. It had great stories, great games. And really, probably the halcyon period of the Premier League. And it was just in time as well, because as we've mentioned previously, you know, English football had went through a dark time with obviously with the Hillsborough tragedy, and you know, problems with hooliganism and you know, cultural upheaval on and off the pitch. You know, it was a time of great unknowns, and when the country as a in general was opening itself up to, you know, a more continental outlook. So yes, it was a very interesting time, and these two managers and these two teams. And this story really, really came about at the right time to help the Premier League explode into what it's become.
It's funny, you know, listen to that. You know, it's fascinating. And you talk about George Graham, you know, ruling with an iron fist, and mm-hmm. and yet this drinking culture that pervaded, you know, through Arsenal. And it I mean, you might know better than I do, but it almost seems at odds with the almost rigid, almost yeah. schoolmaster type mentality that he ran with, and yet this culture was almost a well-known secret, if you like, and it just seems to sit at odds with the manager and the persona and what was trying to be instilled in the club, and yet what seemed to be allowed to be happening.
I think there was a tacit acceptance from Graham that as long as the players performed on match days, which they invariably did, and as long as they give their all in training, which they invariably did, they were almost given, not free rein, but they were let more loose, certainly, than they would be under Arsene Wenger, to, you know, cause as much carnage as they wanted to. You know, Graham was very loyal to his players as long as they performed. You know, the likes of how many times he had to be the likes of Paul Merson out of sticky situations, and, you know, the times that he had to look out for. Even Tony Adams, the club released a statement whenever Adams went to prison, and it was a short, terse statement basically saying that Arsenal stuck by their players, and that was the end of that, really. So I think there was an unwavering loyalty from Graham to his charges, which I think that the players bought into, and you know, the team's performance rewarded that. So there was a trust there that really was a crucial part of the success of that time, I think.
I'm gonna come to Dan in a second, because you know the dominant personality, I suppose, that pervades the 90s, and you know, Dan's gonna chat about that in a second. But I suppose one other thing that I just want to ask you, Chris, is obviously eventually, you know, sort of via Leeds United, George Graham actually pitches up at White Hart Lane. Mm-hmm. As an Arsenal fan, how does that make a fan feel when they pitch up at their bitterest rivals?
From a personal perspective, mercifully, I was still young then, so I didn't. And because I'm not in North London or that close to the city itself, I'm sort of removed from that North London rivalry. But I can certainly recall that some of the invective directed towards Graham's way. But you have to remember as well that, you know, he was trying to rehabilitate his own career, and Tottenham was and is obviously a big club, and unfortunately, he didn't have anywhere near the type of success that he had on the other side of North London, which, depending on your outlook and your loyalty to the Arsenal, is either a good or a bad thing. But I think Graham's legacy will always perhaps be slightly tainted by the way it ended and the circumstances they're in. But the trophies and the standards that he set, particularly in that defence that would go on to get such prolonged success, really speaks for itself.
Yeah, you know, there is certainly legacy there, isn't there? You know, for George Graham, that people still look back on now. So Dan, you know, we come to you, and obviously, you know, we come to Alex Ferguson. Now, Ferguson's legacy is, you know, is forever there, but in those very, very early days, it was debatable whether or not he would be a Manchester United manager for too long, wasn't it?
Yeah, there's the famous story about Mark Robbins scoring that goal away at Forest in the FA Cup in January 1990 that sort of is credited with saving Fergie's job. It's sort of a bit of a mythical story now. Martin Edwards, the chairman at the time, he actually said in Andy Mitten's book Glory Glory, he said basically, you know, he sort of said, well, that wasn't going to happen. He wasn't going to be sacked had he lost that game. Now, of course, had he lost that game, the club wouldn't have won the FA Cup in 1990, which was Fergie's first trophy. So probably very likely that he would have been sacked sort of later on, but I don't think it was as clear cut as you lose this game, you're going. But yeah, it was at that time, and what we need to bear in mind is it was a different financial climate then as well. Pre-Premier League, there wasn't a sort of sea of TV money then. It was gate receipts were basically king during that era, and United's crowds had plummeted. So from sort of, you know, 45,000, 50,000, it dropped as low as 23,000. The average crowd was 10,000 short of capacity. So that was a lot of money in those days. The club needed to sign players that needed to rebuild the Stretford end. And they were banking on the stadium being full week in, week out, which wasn't happening because the team was finishing in mid-table, not really winning any cups at that time. So those sort of first 4 years, 3.5, 4 years were massively difficult for him. But I think the thing that saved him was that the chairman in particular could see what was going on behind the scenes, you know, the recruitment that they were doing, the building of the youth set up. You could tell something was going on behind the scenes, but obviously, you know, results are king, and also the crowds. So that, you know, he needed to win something, and you know, gladly that came in 1990 with the FA Cup.
There's a whole generation that's grown up with Manchester United's success, with Alex Ferguson's success, with Alex Ferguson almost being this overlord of the Premier League. And it, you know, I mean, I teach at a college, and we're always chatting about football when we're supposed to be teaching lessons. But you know, they almost find it difficult to comprehend the, like you say, you talk about these first 4 years of Alex Ferguson's tenure, and it's like I'm talking another language. It's like they don't believe me, or I'm trying to con them, or, you know. But like you say, it was different times. I mean, now a manager would, I mean, you know, we look at Sarri at Chelsea at the moment, and, you know, there's already talk of him moving on or being moved on, and I suppose Ferguson really was very much benefited, like you said, you know, from the time. You know, managers were given more time, chairman more patient, you know, there wasn't this instant sort of knee-jerk reaction to poor results. And I think, you know, it was partly that as well that also saved Ferguson was the time that he was the manager, the time that he took over.
Yeah, and I think also the club realised that when he came in, it was almost like an oil tanker that needed turning around, so it wasn't ever going to be a quick fix. Just like Chris was talking about Arsenal, there was a massive drinking culture, which I think was quite a common theme for most clubs in that era. It was probably, we'll go forward to it later on, but, you know, Wenger's arrival, he introduced a lot of sort of more modern nutrition and drinking culture sort of seemed to go out the window then. But in the mid-80s, early 90s, most clubs suffered with this, and United were no different. So he had a massive big sort of task on his hand to turn the club around, and his you know, his sort of dream was to knock Liverpool off their perch, to paraphrase him. And, you know, it was never going to happen overnight, really. So but, you know, the club could also see what he did with Aberdeen. He came to the club's attention when Aberdeen beat Real Madrid in the 83 Cup Winners' Cup final. So, you know, they could see that he'd had form with Aberdeen in sort of upseating the old firm. So, you know, he had the track record, and I think patience was a virtue really then, that had he gone, you know, who knows what would have happened to the club and the Premier League. But You know, thankfully he got that time, and then, you know, the rest speaks for itself, really, after that first trophy in 1990.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously we're going to keep coming back to Ferguson and his various sort of fallouts and rivalries, you know, as the decade progressed. And like you say, you know, when we get to Wenger, and, you know, and I think it was you, Chris, who talked about, you know, it was perfect for the Premier League. It was perfect time, and it was perfect protagonists. You know, everything was in the right place at the right time, and we'll get to that. But Stephen, you know, I think one guy who, you know, who is worth talking about, and I think I'm right in saying that, you know, he's the last Englishman to actually win the top flight championship in England, you know, and that's Howard Wilkinson with Leeds United, who won the last of the old first division titles. You know, and again, he's the legacy of Howard Wilkinson is almost bound up in the style of football. It's bound up in his in the gruff manner. You know, he seems to, you know, I don't think he gets some of the credit that he possibly deserves for what he achieved with his Leeds United side.
No, not at all. I think in a similar way to George Graham, he's encumbered by the direction that it moved into after his greatest successes. That 1991-92 Leeds side played some very good football. You know, you don't have Gary McAllister in the centre of your midfield. You don't have a player like Gary Speed without playing some good football. You know, he put together a functional side to get out of the second division. Once he did, he jettisoned a lot of those functional players. You know, he brought in Vinnie Jones to get them out of the second division. He did that and then swept him out to replace him with Gary McAllister, a much more aesthetically pleasing central midfielder. You know, you had the intelligence of Gordon Strachan, you had the speed of Rod Wallace, you know, and then you had the bludgeoning Lee Chapman at the top of it. So it was kind of like, you know, a double-sided thing. But, you know, it was a good football inside that Leeds United side. I can remember putting six past Sheffield Wednesday. And this was Sheffield Wednesday, who were the third team in that title race in 91-92. They were way up there. They were really in the mix of it. A lot of people forget that. And Leeds just swept them aside. You know, and that side that he put together, it startled people because they hit the ground running. You know, they only won promotion in 1919. They were champions by 92. Yet they came across as being, you know, a credible force in that first season, that 1991 season. You know, they gave hints of what they were capable of, and then that team at the end of 92, it's amazing how they fall off a cliff, basically. You know, they should have had, you know, with Cantona, the addition of Cantona as well, you know, they had such a foundation to be able to push on for further successes, but how it fell apart was just amazing. You know, that first Premier League campaign, they couldn't buy an away win. They let Cantona go to Manchester United. It was kind of like, up until the autumn of 92, everything that Wilkinson touched for Leeds turned to gold. And beyond that, it basically turned to shit. You know, it's the only way you can put it. Is the you know, he made so many wrong decisions. You know, it was the wrong sale at the wrong time. He would have a habit of making the right purchase at the wrong time sometimes. So like Lee Sharp, you know, should have excelled at Leeds United, you know, did in bursts, but, you know, it just didn't. Nothing he seemed to put together after winning that league title was right for Leeds. And you could just see them slowly unthread, you know. And I think it's the fact that He just struggled so much over those last 3 or 4 years to replicate what he'd done in 92. And I think it's that, and the fact that the style of football descended, you know, it did become functional, it did become, you know, bludgeoning. But it was bludgeoning, but not getting a result. You know, fans will forgive, you know, a functional side if it's getting a tangible result at the end of it. But if you're playing functional, ugly football and getting ugly results, then, you know, that's it. You know? And I think that's just what happened with with Harold Wilkinson at Leeds.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, like, you know, you talked about, obviously Cantona went on, you know, to great things, you know, with Manchester United. But you can argue that actually it was, you know, it was Wilkinson that saw the potential. It was Wilkinson that saw something that could make a difference from a good team into becoming a title winning team. He identified that in Cantona, and like you say, you used it to great effect.
He did. There was a degree of that Leeds United side of kind of like 80, no, early-ish 88, 89, mid 88, 89 when he took over to winning the title in 92. There was a similarity to kind of like Brian Clough's Nottingham Forest. You know, he picked up players who had fallen by the wayside elsewhere that were clearly talented. And he put them to good use, you know. So Cantona excelled, you know, although he only kind of like operated in cameo roles. Steve Hodge did a massive underrated job for them in that title winning season. He came from the bench and scored goals on a regular basis like he'd never scored before, you know, for always a decent underrated midfielder, Steve Hodge. But and then he just found these things like Chris Fairclough, who'd come to the fore at Nottingham Forest and then faded away. But then he got this second wind under Wilkinson at Leeds. Chris White was another who'd come through at Arsenal. Big things were expected of him, and then he was sold on because it wasn't working, and Tony Adams came through, and Martin Keown came through, and David O'Leary was still there. So White was moved along. He ended up playing in America and then West Brom in the second division. But then he was picked up by Wilkinson because Wilkinson he saw something in him. So it was similar to how Brian Clough picked up players like Kenny Burns and Frank Clark, who were seen as surplus to requirements at other clubs. And he put this side together that you can point at Gordon Strachan within that. You know, Strachan was part of that early regime change of Alex Ferguson at Manchester United that Paul McGrath was swept out in. These players that could have served him well for a number of more years, but Ferguson felt that he was better off moving on to you know, other players that might have gave him a different aspect behind the scenes on the training ground and in the dressing room and moving away from those drinking cultures that we've spoken about. But yeah, Wilkinson's Leeds at that time, leading up to the title, drew a lot of comparisons with Clough's Nottingham Forest for me.
You're right. I mean, the names you mentioned there with Forest, and obviously, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, Brian Clough across the 70s and the 80s, and it's very much an underrated skill, if you like, of a manager to be able to identify players who've maybe been cast aside or players who are perceived to be past their best, and yet some managers just seem to be able to tap into whatever it is that drives those players, and they almost look like new players or players who've shed sort of 4 or 5 years. And it's very, you know, people talk about technical ability, tactical ability, but actually getting the best out of a player, or being able to identify what gets the best out of a player, is actually the sign of a very good football manager.
Yeah, it's that concept of having your, you know, pattern for a team. It's that idea of a team in your mind. It's that template. This is the team that I want to put out there. And it's figuring out those personalities. It's as much the personality of a player than it is the style of a player. That a certain player that can do a specific job that you have imagined that you need doing in that team. And Wilkinson managed to do that.
I suppose we can't talk about the 1990s without, you know, probably the greatest television managerial meltdown. And Dan, I'm going to blame your man for it. But essentially, you know, we look at Keegan, who also then comes into the sort of the managerial four, you know, across the 1990s. And I'll get all of your opinions on Keegan, because I find him a fascinating character in terms of a manager. But starting with you, Dan, I mean, Ferguson really, in my opinion, gave him a lesson in the art, and we've just talked about what makes a good manager, but in the art of the mind games and the psychological impact of being a football manager in the Premier League and the pressure that went with that?
Yeah, I think Ferguson is sort of, he's credited with ruining Keegan, isn't he, in that, during that season. And I was thinking about this the other day, and Ferguson really, we'll get onto Wenger in a while, I'm sure, but he's almost like a parasite in the way that he sort of, he clamped himself on to a person or a club, and he was never really the same when he didn't have that animosity with someone, that, you know, a rivalry that he created in his own head. So talked about the Old Firm before, and then when he arrived at United, it was all about Liverpool. You know, he wanted to unseat Liverpool. And then, you know, in the mid-90s, Keegan was one in his crosshairs as well. And he was always at his best when he had someone to go to war with, really. And, yeah, that the I Would Love It rant is just... It's going to be repeated forever, isn't it? And it came about when Ferguson questioned... I think it was about a month before the end of the season. He questioned whether teams would try as hard against Newcastle as they would against Man United. And it was after a game against Elland Road, against Leeds at Elland Road, I believe, when Newcastle had gone there and won. And he just absolutely lost the plot. And Newcastle were 10 or 12 points clear at one point during that season at the turn of the year, and ended up losing the league by 4 points. So I think Keegan definitely lost out on the mind games there. But there were also a couple of really key points in that season as well. There was a game at St James's Park in March where United won 1-0 against Newcastle. Cantona scored. Schmeichel was imperious that night. I wrote about it in the recent Virtuoso series. And it's just raised thin margins like that. You know, had Schmeichel not performed so well that night, Newcastle could have drawn or even won the game, and then we'd be talking about a different league title. So I think, you know, people sort of talk about Newcastle being gung-ho and being fragile, but I think we forget how razor thin the margins are. But it's undoubtable that they did throw away a big lead in sort of 5-6 months. But I think you've got to also give credit to Man United as well for just that relentless Ferguson style assault on the league, really.
It's funny. I remember that game. I remember that 1-0 game. In fact, I can remember the pub I watched it in and everything. And you're right. They are the fine margins. And like I said, I'm going to come to you in a sec, Chris, just for an opinion on Keegan. But you know, Keegan's reputation and like you say, we've talked about legacy quite a bit, you know, already tonight. And you know, Keegan's legacy is almost bound up in probably those final sort of 10, 12 weeks of that season. Seems to define him, you know, almost as a football manager. And you're right. You look at Schmeichel's performance that night, and it was incredible. You know, for all that Cantona achieved, you know, with United, but you're right. You look at Schmeichel in that game, and there are turning points in history or moments in history where you look and you can see where things are won and lost. And Schmeichel's performance that night was absolutely incredible, absolutely incredible. But Chris, you know, sort of coming to you as a, you know, we talked about neutrals and, you know, and Arsenal being everybody's favourite team to hate, and then everybody's favourite team to second team or team to love. But, you know, in terms of Keegan, what is your perception of him as a football manager?
I think Keegan is a very interesting case, and that interview at that famous meltdown, in my mind, illustrates both his greatest strength and his greatest weakness as a manager. I mean, the passion and enthusiasm in the words during that interview, you can just imagine being on the receiving end of that in the dressing room and going onto the pitch fully pumped up and ready to die in battle. And, you know, Keegan has a long history of being able to motivate his players. He did it at Man City as well. He did it for a short spell at Newcastle. And throughout his career, it's a managerial sense anyway, it's peppered by, you know, upheavals in terms of playing styles, you know, attacking football and the inevitable collapse. And I think that's the other end of the spectrum as far as Keegan's managerial career is concerned. There's this sense that, excuse me, there's a lack of attention to detail with regards to tactical preparation, a certain naivety, especially with matters off the field. But the razor-thin margins we talked about, I think they would arguably be more important with regards to his legacy than any sort of media faux pas. And I think that's something we can't help but do. You know, we tend to draw conclusions based on the information that's, you know, most memorable to us. But I think Schmeichel's performance that night was arguably more of a key factor. Ferguson has always been skilled at that sort of the mental gymnastics side of the game. But I think, you know, in terms of the actual performances of the players, Manchester United's players put in more consistent battle-hardened performances when it mattered. And I think that sort of, you know, Newcastle were performing above expectations for a long period of time, and then that was in part due to the Keegan's own achievements at the club. So, you know, Manchester United had more experience on it, and I think that perhaps came to bear more so as the pressure came on. But I think Keegan, and you've seen it whenever he resigned from the England managerial role after losing to Germany in that friendly game. You know, he's a man that appears from the outset anyway to be driven by emotion. And when things are going well, that is a tidal wave the players can ride. But when things and the chips are down, it's almost as though he struggles to maintain that equilibrium and really approach games with sort of a cold, objective tactical focus. And I think that has always been his downfall.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Stephen, you know, I'll come to you. And obviously Keegan is, you know, incredibly fondly remembered at Liverpool, you know, as a player. And I suppose just quickly, your opinion on Keegan as a manager, and then I'm going to get your perspective on the sort of the Graeme Souness years at Liverpool and your thoughts and perceptions on those. Looking at, obviously, I know Keegan never managed Liverpool, but looking at two ex-Liverpool iconic players and then their sort of sidestep, if you like, into management. But first of all, Keegan as a manager, what are your thoughts?
Keegan manager, he's I think Dan probably have the better opinion on it, because he was, you know, his team saw him up front in a very tense and, you know, emotional title race at times.
Yeah, just one thing I wanted to mention just popped into my head a minute ago. When basically, you know, everyone sort of, they were called the entertainers, weren't they? And people sort of said that they were an attacking team, but they had a soft underbelly. Stephen, you'll remember those 2-4-3 games at Anfield. Yeah. I thought you'd be there, and they're sort of a couple of the most classic games of the early Premier League years. But the thing that struck me, I wrote a piece about Asprilla for These Football Times, and I spoke to a Newcastle fan at the time, and he actually said, Keegan, it wasn't actually Asprilla really that he's often credited with being the sort of person who came in and upset the apple cart, but actually it was Keegan trying to be more conservative that actually backfired. He signed David Batty from Leeds, and he just completely sort of upset the balance in the midfield and made them much more defensive. And that's kind of one of the things that it led to their form dipping drastically in the latter half of the season. So, you know, we always see him as this sort of romantic, swashbuckling manager. But actually, when he went against his instincts and tried to be more defensive and tried to shore the team up a bit, it actually backfired, which you see a lot, don't you, with, you know, managers like Mourinho with Fellaini sort of sending on the more defensive-minded midfielder, and you think it's going to actually shore things up, but it has the opposite effect.
Yeah, it is. It's that concept of a manager going against the grain, you know, and I don't know why they do it, but, you know, for my mind's eye, that's Keegan. Keegan at his best was just following his instinct, you know, and whether that was, you know, within that you had to kind of like embrace the frailties in it. Show more so, but again, as England manager, tactically he was, to me at least, always a little bit just not well footed. Really, he was better off just going for it. He was when he was comfortable and he was happy and just let his teams go for it. You know, it was almost like that toy you had as a kid where you'd rev the wheels back and just let it go. And that was Keegan for me. You know, there was such beauty in it. but it was built on sand, you know. It was built on sand.
So I mean, I suppose you come to, you know, for me, certainly somebody who's a very, or seems to come across as a very opposite in terms of personality, and, you know, and Graeme Souness. And I'm interested, certainly, you know, from your point of view, seeing as a Liverpool fan, on your perspective of Souness's reign at Anfield.
Souness at Anfield, he changed too much too quick, and he's admitted that himself since. What he had on his hands was an ageing squad, but it was one that was in need of evolution rather than a revolution. And he set out with this revolution to sweep out the old guard. The legend has it that he walked in and said, look, anyone who doesn't want to be part of this, you know, let it be known now and we'll get you out of the club. And some players took him up on it, whereas the Liverpool way of doing things was always a case of you only replace a player once you have a better or a more long-term viable option to come in and replace that player.
And yeah, Souness would have known that, wouldn't he? Coming through the boot room, and you know he was there.
He knew the club back to front, but he wasn't one for tradition. You know, there was the rebuilding of some renovations done to the old main stand, and he didn't stop the fabled boot room, for instance, being knocked down for an extended media centre, for instance. And it was just little things like that, you know, and that rubbed up a lot of the fans the wrong way. But just on a purely footballing basis, he just tried to change things too quickly. It's stuff like kind of like, you know, allowing players of immense experience go for what were inferior replacements, basically. You know, he allowed Peter Beardsley to go to Everton but brought in Dean Saunders. Steve McMahon went and in came Michael Thomas, who I have a lot of time for. Michael Thomas was a good player, but he wasn't the direct replacement for him. Eventually, he brought in Paul Stewart from Tottenham. It was expensive mistakes like that. Neil Ruddock, Julian Dix, players who just weren't Liverpool players. But conversely, his eye for younger players was fantastic. A lot of young players prospered under him. Robbie Fowler, you know, the certain players, they would not have come through under Dalglish in the manner that they did. You know, he won. You know, he picked up Rob Jones from kind of like Crewe, who'd started the 91-92 season playing at left back for Crewe. He ended the season playing in the FA Cup final for Liverpool at right back, and would have gone to the 1992 European Championships had he not been injured. So you know, there was a lot of good that Souness did, but the opposite side of the coin was that he dispensed with a lot of the experienced players that could have done a lot for those younger players in conjunction with them in the squad. You know, if you can imagine, like, you know, the likes of Robbie Fowler and Jamie Redknapp and Rob Jones coming through with the likes of Steve McMahon still there, Ray Houghton still there. You know, they would, you know, Gary Gillespie was another one that was allowed to leave, and some of it was on the basis of the return to Europe, where you could only play, I think it was 3 or 4 non-English players. So, but that included Welsh and Irish and Scottish players. So he flooded the squad with English-born players. So this is why the likes of Ruddock and Dix would come along, why he signed Mark Wright. Mark Wright, in theory, should have been a Liverpool player, and he was, belatedly he was, because he had a second coming where he looked the part. But, you know, Souness just made too many rash moves too quickly.
It's funny because, you know, you talk about that, and you talk about the, again, sort of this instant knee-jerk reaction and the gruff demeanour. And I suppose coming to you, Chris, you know, probably the greatest contrast that you can possibly have to Souness and that type of managerial approach. And, you know, and that's the arrival of Arsene Wenger, which to me was another major shift in terms of the trajectory and the development of English football and what Wenger brought to management, what Wenger brought to preparation, what Wenger brought to English football, you know, was like nothing we've ever seen, and is and will be his, you know, his legacy from his time at Arsenal.
Yeah, and of course, it might not have happened because Wenger originally could have signed for the club in 1995, but Peter Hillwood, who was the chairman at the time, decided against it in favour of Bruce Rioch, and quite an interesting parallel there with Graeme Souness, a dour man who's an intense focus on discipline, that he was believed that he could bring a bit of control to a dressing room that it was perceived was difficult to manage with a lot of egos. But it was Rioch's personality clashes, especially with the likes of Ian Wright, and a dispute over transfer funds that eventually had him leave and allow Wenger to come in. But I think, whenever I think about Wenger, this might sound a bit pretentious, but it's like whenever you watch an old film that someone's been telling you about, it's a classic, and you watch it and you think, well, why is this so special? And it's because you're judging it outside of the context of it when it was originally made. If football today is, if things like preparation, nutrition, fitness, and emphasis on technical football seem mundane, well, it's because Wenger was the vanguard, the person at that vanguard who made it mundane. He introduced a lot of these and popularised this and really prompted that paradigm shift, at least when it came to English football. And his achievements are even more spectacular, really, particularly in those early first years when you consider the club that he came to at that time. This was a club that had been dogged by the George Graham scandal. There's a drinking culture we've already mentioned. And, Arsenal was competing with bigger clubs at that time who had bigger budgets, bigger stadiums. And the club itself didn't even have a training ground. We were sharing training facilities with University College London. So Wenger inherited a dressing room full of established egos and really set up to fail. And the changes he implemented, not only the changes themselves, but the way he implemented them and the way he worked with what he had, first of all, he recognised the strength of the defence and the characters that he inherited. And crucially, I think some of the early things he did, first and foremost, really prompted a whole wave of contract renewals for his players. He was actually reported to be quite shocked by how little money a lot of his stars were on. So that immediately got up a lot of the players on side. And I think he was very important ally for Tony Adams whenever he decided to go public with his alcoholism bottle. So I think Wenger was very cute politically, but I don't think that was from any Machiavellian sense on his part. I think this was just the manifestation of an extreme loyalty that Wenger has to his players, and something that often comes to his detriment as well. He clings to underperforming stars underperforming stars for perhaps too long when they didn't repay him. But in those early days, he really did a lot to get the players on side. Now, in terms of the actual changes he implemented, training, especially for the established stars, was a complete culture shock. And, in one of the first meetings he had with the players, he emphasised that this would be about changing the club's culture. And we all know about the changes to diet, the bringing in of the lean meats, the creatine, the energy supplements, the emphasis on prior preparation, looking after your body, things like plyometrics, which seem so really basic nowadays, were revolutionary then, the likes of yoga. But Wenger wasn't stringent when he didn't have to be. If players were a bit reluctant to some of the changes, he allowed for that pushback and wasn't dictatorial about that. So he was very acute to the situation that he was presented with, and I think he managed that transitional period very well. But of course, all the changes and all the stretches in the world won't matter if there isn't a commensurate improvement on the pitch. And I think that leads us into his signings. And at that time, English football was still quite insular, particularly with regards to talents on the continent. And Wenger, of course, had that advantage, particularly in the Francophone market, with the likes of young French and African talent that he didn't have a lot of competition for, that he had seen personally. There wasn't a lot of coverage about these young talents. Nowadays, it's unthinkable for a player like Patrick Vieira to be playing in the reserve team of AC Milan, but that's where he was plucked from for a fee from about 3 million. And the likes of Sylvain Wiltord, Robert Pires, Thierry Henry, all players, perhaps with the slight exception of Wiltord, who was there by 13 million from Bordeaux. All these players, international quality stars, but bought at, you know, relatively low prices. And I think that there was really that sort of market edge, particularly in the first decade, where, which was so successful, that really set Arsene Wenger apart. He was alive to the economic possibilities in a way that other managers perhaps weren't. And I think it was a strategy that, and we'll probably come on to this later at some point, but Ferguson had great admiration for and, you know, tried to copy around, you know, the beginning of the millennium, particularly with the captures of players like David Bellion and Eric Jemba-Jemba, but the less said about those two, the better. but Wenger, there was a sense of, you know, being in the right place at the right time. You know, if it wasn't Wenger who implemented these changes, this was a culture shift that was always going to come to English football. But he was the one that had the courage first to bring the ideas in the face of criticism and stick with them. And the results and the players engaged with those methods, and the results really spoke for themselves.
It's funny, the way you've just finished there, I was just about to say, it's almost like there was, you know, we talk about a perfect storm, and it was almost like the Premier League was crying out for an Arsene Wenger, you know, who's crying out for that mentality to come in. And like you said, you know, it happened to be Arsene Wenger, and it happened to be with Arsenal, you know, and the rest is history. But I absolutely agree. I think English football was ready, and it was the right time for that sort of almost a revolution, like you say, from top to bottom, as a, you know, a revolution within a football club, you know, and even within English football. And Wenger was, you know, the perfect person to take advantage of that. But I'm going to come to you, Dan. Now, obviously, you know, Wenger's arrival, you know, was a shock to English football. You know, and Ferguson by this point had very much established himself. He'd, you know, he'd sort of seen off the rivals one by one and was ticking them off. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's faced with Wenger, and, you know, it was almost, I don't think Alex Ferguson changed, because I don't think he was a man ever for changing, but it almost forced him to just take a step back and rethink his approach almost to how he'd gone about winning league titles and dominating domestic football before that.
Yeah, first of all, the gloves are off now that Chris has mentioned Bellion and Jemba-Jemba.
Just say Igor Stepanos, it's okay.
Yeah, Pascal Saigon. Yeah, no, like I mentioned before, you know, Ferguson, he was always at his best when he had a rival. You know, the times when the sort of club dipped a bit, had a, you know, one or two or three year spell, finishing second or third or fourth, it was like a window where there was no real rival, and whenever he had someone to go up against was when he was just at his best, and Wenger was that, you know. Wenger was brilliant for English football, and it was at a time really when there were no foreign managers in the Premier League. We, you know, so slow to embrace foreign managers. I think when he took over at Arsenal, the only other foreign manager in the Premier League was Ruud Gullit at Chelsea. I'm not sure if he was player manager then or full on manager, but, you know, we were quicker to embrace foreign players, but with foreign managers it was much slower, and Wenger was actually ridiculed on his arrival. I think a lot of it was to do with the way he looked, where he came from. He came from Japan, and people didn't really take him too seriously. Ferguson actually said halfway through the Wenger's first season that, you know, he's a novice and he should keep his opinions to Japanese football, which, you know, would prove to be a bit ridiculous in time. But yeah, no, I mean, my memories of Wenger, you know, that Arsenal team, his first sort of great Arsenal team in 98 when Arsenal did the double, it was an unbelievable team. He built on the foundations of George Graham, so to give him credit, you know, with that famous back four, David Seaman, Ray Parlour on the right, I think. We had, it was Ian Wright up front was it Ian Wright and Anelka up front? And, you know, Overmars on the left, unbelievable. And then Vieira and Petit in the middle. So it was kind of like almost like a hybrid of George Graham's solid workman-like team with the sort of flair and the pace of the French lads and Overmars. It was, they were a frightening team, and And that 98 team really forced Ferguson to make some changes, and the changes that came in 98 with Jaap Stam, Dwight York, Jesper Blomqvist, Keane came back from a year out injured. So, you know, it almost kick-started Ferguson. Maybe a few years he'd gone a bit soft because, you know, United won so much during those first 5 or 6 years of the decade, and maybe it took Wenger to wake United up and wake Ferguson up, and then the rivalry from there. You know, Chris mentioned the Battle of Old Trafford in 1990, which was kind of one of the first instances in the rivalry between the two clubs, because it, you know, rivalries are often geographical or political or historical, and you get other ones where it's based on who's going for titles at the time. And United and Arsenal never really had a massive rivalry until the 1990s, and then when Wenger came in, it really kick-started. But, you know, from that time on, 97, 98, that's when it really kicked in, and the next 5 or 6 years were a bit of a roller coaster.
Time's against us, but I've got a couple more things that I want to cover. I'm going to come to you in a second, Stephen. But we always finish this with, you know, with who was the best manager, you know, in the decade, in your opinion. And I'm pretty sure I know where Dan and Chris, where your lighters are going to lie, and I'm kind of going to want to know a little bit about why. But before I come to you two to ask, Stephen, just before we move on to picking, you know, who we think are the best managers, is Ferguson, because I know you've just been sat there just relaxing and just listening to the two lads go at it.
I've reached the popcorn.
Is Ferguson and Wenger, I did a hybrid then, Wenger, I didn't call them, you know, is that the greatest managerial rivalry, you know, in English football?
Of its era, it was. I mean, you can go through every decade, you know, if you call Ferguson Wenger the best one, then, you know, all of those rivalries of the 70s in particular, you know, anything to do with Clough, you know, you could put out. So, yeah, but no, it was of its time, you know, every year it has these great rivalries, and it's almost like a passing on the baton. And at the beginning of the 1990s, it's very much Dalglish and George Graham. It very quickly morphs into Wilkinson versus Ferguson, but Wilkinson falls away. Keegan comes along, and then it's Wenger, you know. So, you know, the 1990s are all to do with Alex Ferguson and his myriad of rivals, and throughout that 1990s span, and into the new millennium, it's Ferguson, Wenger that lasts the test of time. That hard push to say if it's the greatest one, you know, because there are so many out there. And within clusters, I think, you know, you can point to the clusters of the 60s and the 70s, but certainly way, way up there in the top five, certainly.
And I think talking about, you know, passing the baton, Mourinho comes in 2004-2005, wasn't it? Arsenal won the league in 2004, they won the FA Cup in 2005, but
then along comes it turns into Mourinho versus Ferguson and...
Mourinho versus everyone.
Mourinho versus himself.
Well, I think that Arsenal really interests me in sort of, you know, after that 2004, 2005, when they won the last couple of trophies for a best part of a decade. You know, Wenger's teams from when he took over 96 to 2005, you know, we've talked about them. They were... The thing that I noticed about Arsenal is I used to despise majority of the players. They had, in my opinion, a lot of hateful figures. I couldn't stand Keown, still can't. Jens Lehmann was not a very nice man, to put it politely. And they all, but what they did have is they had a lot of players who could play football, but they, you know, they had a bit of needle about them. And then sort of around 2004, 2005, and with the drought that Arsenal had, the players just seemed to. I don't know whether it was the recruitment, whether it was to do with the stadium move, but Wenger seemed to go from that kind of player to players that wanted to, you know, sort of nice players who would like to sort of play passing football, possession football. It was a complete switch. So I don't know what Chris has got to say about that kind of switch. And Arsenal, just from then on, really, I don't know, there wasn't really a rivalry with United after 2004, 2005, really. And I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that, A, they weren't, Arsenal weren't really competing for titles, but the players were just a lot more passive.
I think you've slightly touched on it there. The stadium effectively hamstrung Wenger, and this is something that has never really been given the exposure it deserves. I mean, in John Cross's book about Arsene Wenger, he reveals that the club itself was a week away from bankruptcy because of the costs of the stadium. This is something that Wenger never publicised, and whenever the club had no money for transfers, it was something that he never highlighted. He never tried to shift the blame away from, you know, his own purported failures. And I think that the lack of available money forced his hand, really. Firstly, to sell the club's established stars and sort of reframe the club's recruitment strategy to younger prospects. Now, whenever you're dealing with younger players, they're you know, by definition, almost more meek. They're less self-assured. You're buying less established stars. Often, it's as simple as, you know, in terms of physical stature, they're not as big. And whilst being talented, as you said, there are the players that we recruited certainly from 2005 onwards were lacked that physical robustness. I mean, and this was part of a wider trend in Europe, you know, but perhaps epitomised by Pep Guardiola's Barcelona. But I think it was something that technical blueprint that Wenger tried to implement in England, particularly towards the end of the 2010s. But I think he overlooked the need for an element of physicality that the teams require in the Premier League. And I think once we had a few difficult years of that, there was a perception that set in, both with our opponents and in the club itself, that Arsenal were a bit of a soft touch. And I think Patrice Evra really summed it up when he said, after a Champions League game semi-final, I think it was against Arsenal, that it felt like men against boys. And not for any Arsenal fan who'd watched the club's decline from the 2004 of Lehman, of Touré, of Sol Campbell, really hit the nail on the head. There were certain personalities and characteristics and traits that might have made these people, you know, someone you wouldn't want to have at a dinner party, but someone you would want to have alongside you on the football pitch. And I think with the likes of Roy Keane at United, John Terry at Chelsea, Jamie Carragher to a lesser extent at Liverpool, all people who you could rely on in a street fight, and Arsenal let those characters go and didn't really replace them. And I think it was to our detriment as well.
Yeah, I think as well, you know, it's also sort of and the change of an era, isn't it? And modern footballers are a lot different now than they were in the mid-90s. I mean, the game the other week at the Emirates, the 3-1 in the Cup, there was, you know, it was... You look at the sort of people on the pitch and there's no real players of that ilk, and it was a you know, a fairly uneventful game, and that you can just... That game, for me, just sort of epitomised the fact that the rivalry, really, you know, between United and Arsenal, and it's completely dead, really, you know, from any kind of... Neither team are going for the title, of course, but, you know, there's no real sort of lasting legacy of that rivalry now. It's almost as if it never happened. And you know, I think a lot of the players on either side kind of epitomise that, really.
I think as well, sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
It's, you know, the club has, the financial thing aside, you know, it's just that perception that has set in now. But I think the end of the rivalry really was noticeable whenever Ferguson's demeanour towards the club at Arsenal changed. He had plenty more warm words for Wenger and a lot more time for him personally, and I think that reflected his fall from the status of competitor. And that was something that was very noticeable from an Arsenal fan's perspective. We were no longer a team to be feared. And that was probably the toughest thing to take, considering how fiercely that the teams had competed between 96 and 2004.
That's a great point. You're right. That's a fantastic point. The minute Ferguson deems a manager or deems a team not to be a threat, you kind of know you're in a little bit of trouble. So to finish that, and Stephen, you're going to play a really important part, because I'm assuming you're going to have a deciding vote in a minute.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask you all for just looking at the 1990s, who was the standout manager and the reason why. So I'll start with you, Dan. I think I know where you're going, But who's the standout manager for you from the 1990s?
Obviously, Howard Wilkinson. No. yeah, no, I mean, you know what I'm going to say. It's got to be Ferguson, really. And sorry to disappoint you, but I don't want to denigrate Arsene Wenger in any way. But I think, you know, you look at the longevity, which Wenger was brilliant as well, but Ferguson lasted for, you know, quarter of a century, and he built sort of 3, 4, 5 great sides. You know, Wenger had that first side in 98, and then, you know, the invincible side. But Ferguson had you know, best part of 4 or 5 great teams that he rebuilt. You know, had a year or two where it went a bit quiet as he was building under the surface, and then came back with a great team. And I think that shows really his adaptability. You know, over the years he could adapt to different styles of football, different people coming in, like, you know, the likes of Mourinho as well. So I have to go with Ferguson. I can't really. And I think as well, Wenger, one thing that held him back, he never won a European Cup. I know they came close in 2006, but that was one thing really that eluded his great teams.
Oh, right, Chris. He's put forward a good case, to be fair, as Dan. Your selection for the outstanding manager.
Well, I'm torn between creating an artificial sense of drama here and going with what my head is telling me, and unfortunately, I'd have to agree that Ferguson is was certainly the better manager, and I think for the reasons that Dan has identified, the longevity of success, the ability to constantly evolve. Ferguson wasn't a manager who ever stood still. In his earlier career, he was, you know, a control freak. Every aspect of the club was monitored from top to bottom. Players were followed on nights out. But he responded to the changing landscape, often in his later years, delegating training to his coaches, routinely cycling in and out assistant managers, René Mullenstein, Carlos Queiroz, people who were antidotes to his style. And, you know, he really made fulsome use of the staff and resources around him, something that Arsene Wenger never really quite mastered. Wenger was more lent on that dictatorial instinct a lot more in his later years, to his detriment, than Ferguson did. I think Wenger deserves special mention, precisely because of all the reasons we've already outlined, his impact on the English game as a whole. You know, the style of play that he implemented, the various changes, his eye for sculpting talents, you know, his success in the transfer market, and how he navigated Arsenal's managed decline from 2004 onwards, because I think under a coach of lesser magnitude, Arsenal could have had a more precipitous decline than they actually did. I think his continued participation in the Champions League, those things, something like 16 straight qualifications, is whenever the full facts of Arsenal's troubles about that decade really come to light, will cause us to pause and re-examine Arsene Wenger's success in that latter half. It didn't have the trophies of the first half, but it was still an impressive feat, given all the restrictions that he had and obstacles that they were put in his way. However, when it comes down to it, it's about trophies, it's about winning titles, and when it comes to Ferguson, there's no one better. So, unfortunately, I'm sorry, Stephen, to rob you of the deciding vote, but it has to be Ferguson.
Oh, that's very magnanimous of you, Chris. I'm very impressed.
Done every word.
Yeah, I bet. It's right, I'll edit it out, don't worry about it. So, Stephen, then you free vote now. You don't need to worry. You don't need to play the Len Goodman role anymore. You're all right. You can say who you want.
Well, considering we missed out on the John Beck section of the of the podcast, I will have to go for Alex Ferguson. And Chris used the word evolution, and that's what it was. You know, he did what, you know, all those great Liverpool managers did for a long, long time, and it was managing to have a team that ticks over and ticks over and ticks over for, you know, a 15, 20-year period. It takes some doing, and there's not many managers that have managed to do that. But Ferguson's one of them, and he dominates the whole 1990s landscape. It's all about Ferguson, and, you know, he has a clutch of rivals that spike all the way through that decade. But it's Ferguson from start to end.
Brilliant. Well, fellas, it's been an absolute pleasure. You know, it really has. There's been fascinating discussion, plenty of passion, certainly plenty of insight. And, you know, all that's left to do really is to thank you very much for joining us. Thank you very much for your contributions. Dan, brilliant. Please don't leave it too long before you come back. Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you, Stu. And I was just about to say, if anyone is enjoying this podcast, look out for the series coming soon. Ooh. About the 90s.
Yes, but nicely played. Chris, have you got another message at a hidden level like Dan has? Dan's on fire. Again, thank you, you know, Chris, for joining us. Please don't leave it too long before coming back.
No, I'm just wondering who John Beck is, but that's besides the point. Oh, no, it's a pleasure to be back on.
You don't want to know who John Beck is.
No.
You don't. I wrote about him in the Philosophies magazine. It was the most painful article I think I've ever written in my life. It was horrendous.
Yeah, if you like your astro pitches sanded in parts.
Yeah.
John Beck's the man for you. Yeah.
Positions of maximum opportunity. It's horrendous. It's a horrible, horrible read. And I wrote it.
That's a ringing endorsement.
I know. Stephen.
Buy it while you can.
Yeah, get it here. Stephen, obviously, as always, thank you very much. I'd like to make it, you know, sort of everybody aware that this managerial rivalry has been your brainchild. It's been your, you know, your baby, and you're the one who's put it together, you know, sort of from start to finish. And I've just been lucky enough to tag along for the ride, like I just seem to do every now and then. It's been brilliant. It's been absolutely fascinating going through the, you know, going through the decades and, you know, and discussing.
It's been great. And to hear so many different perspectives as well has been good, because we've had, you know, Dan and Chris, we've had Paul and Tom and Gary, of course. So, you know, we've had, you know, plenty of contributions there, and they've all brought something completely different to the series. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, it has. So finally, you know, thank you to the listeners. Thank you for listening. Like Dan said, keep a lookout for the new series that's coming. And certainly if you've enjoyed this particular episode, and all that's left for me to say is thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.